Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from April 15th to April 21st. Hey, Anthony, want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric. How you going? So it's been quite a big week for ETHub because we launched the ETHub call and forum. But just before I get into that, I did want to announce that the guys over at Consensus at Earthreal, they reached out to us and they wanted us to kind of get the word out about their virtual hackathon that's going on at the moment. And at ETHub, we love to amplify this sort of stuff, especially for developers. So if you'll see in the newsletter that the virtual hackathon is going from the 15th of April to the 30th of April. So we're a bit late, but you can still get involved. You can still sign up. The links are all in the newsletter. There's awesome prizes to be running. One, including free tickets to Earthreal, the event in New York. And then you can present your project live on stage. So it's a great opportunity to get your project in front of, many people, because Ether is quite a popular event. So do definitely get involved. You don't have to be a dev either. There's plenty of tracks available for all types of entrepreneurs. So just go check that one out. The ETHub call we the ETHub forum we launched this week. So basically a place for people to go to that kind of feel underrepresented in the community. They don't fit into kind of the Ethereum Magicians or maybe the ETH Research Forum. So we saw explosive growth on that already. Like it was amazing. Almost 200 people have signed up using Twitter to sign up as a user. We have a ton of anonymous users. We can see in our stats, a ton of people are reading the site. I think it was over 10,000 page views or something. There's a lot of topics already. You know, Vitalik posted in there about getting feedback on a new proposal for ETH2 rewards, which we'll talk about a little bit later. It's just been awesome. And like the first call will be on May 7th, which I think is next week or something. Eric, did you want to talk a bit more about that one?
Yeah, for sure. So we've mentioned this on a couple of the weekly recaps and we had tweeted a decent amount about it. But, you know, it's just kind of like we realize that, you know, the core devs have their call and there's a couple of different forums out there more specialized like the ETH Magicians and ETH Research. There wasn't really a place for like stakeholders outside of that. So I guess I would kind of see the core contributors on the forum and the call being more general users, investors, dApp devs, and obviously core devs too, right? There's already a couple that are commenting on posts on there. You mentioned Vitalik and Lane's in there and stuff like that. So it's open to everybody. We're going to have a call once a month to kind of like summarize the top six topics. Like we're going to try and go for a 15-minute per topic. We'll have an agenda. It'll be live stream and record, although we haven't figured out the logistics of that live streaming quite yet. So don't fully quote me on that for the first, you know, one or two till we figure out the tech side of it. But it should be pretty easy. So, you know, yeah, go contribute to the forum. I think one thing that we kind of take pride on ourselves with is we mentioned this on our roadmap and we like to just ship content. And we said we were going to do this and it's out there now. And we're just going to kind of see how it grows and what it exactly grows into and kind of take it from there.
Yeah, exactly. It's great that we got this out there because, people were like kind of calling out for something like this, especially on Twitter, because we have Twitter, we have Reddit. A lot of people get involved. A lot of people write these long form things, but they kind of get lost because it's an ever evolving platform in Twitter and Reddit. It's not really a forum. It's more of a, you know, up to the minute kind of thing, especially on Twitter, right? You write something awesome, like a tweet thread, and it just gets lost completely. So the forum allows you to write that, get, you know, direct feedback from people and it kind of be more of an archival state than Reddit or Twitter, which is really cool. Keep an eye on our Twitter for announcements. I'm going to put out a blog post in the next couple of days just going through exactly what the call is going to be and what we hope to achieve with the forum, just so we got it formalized and documented for everyone. The call is going to be a kind of, as Eric said, it's going to be an evolving thing where we work out what works best for the call. We don't know exactly what works best. We don't know if we should open it up to everyone or if it should be kind of not an invite only to speak, but like if you've got something to talk about because you've posted it on the forum, then you'd get to speak, obviously, because then if we let everyone speak, it just becomes like we expect there to be quite a turnout on the call. So it just becomes quite noisy. So yeah, we'll formalize all that. We'll put out the blog post. We'll get feedback on it and we'll iterate on it. At the end of the day, this is a community thing. We won't just be dictating how it runs. So yeah.
One thing to mention on that too is the only way that you can become a contributor on the call is by being a contributor on the forum. So if you're interested having your voice heard eventually on the call, that requires that you become a type of core contributor. Like Discourse works on kind of like a merit system. So the more you post and the better you do, well, not really better you do, but the better community member you are in the forum, you kind of move up in like their ranking system. So we haven't completely figured out how we're going to figure out who's going to be on the call yet, but at an absolute minimum, you have to come contribute to the community. So if you're interested in that, definitely get on it.
Yeah, that makes total sense, of course. I think people would agree with us on that. So yeah, moving on from that quickly, Eric, you put out the official, you posted it to the Ethereum GitHub repo this week for EIP-1559, the official proposal for it. Did you want to walk through just a quick recap of what that was and what you did?
Yeah, definitely. I guess kind of a funny story here. Initially, it was actually just an issue titled 1559 and didn't really realize it wasn't a formalized EIP until Boris brought it up in one of the calls. I believe it was a core dev call and they were walking through. So put it out there, obviously with a lot of help from Vitalik. So thanks to him for helping that out. It was kind of his original idea and paper that led to this. We've talked about it a decent amount on the show, so I don't want to dive too much into the details of it, but it's essentially kind of trying to fix this, what I would call broken fee market we have now. At least at a minimum, it's very price inefficient and it's horrible, in my opinion, for user experience. So there were talks in Berlin. The videos aren't quite up yet. I heard they had some weird like music copyright issues because YouTube was catching like background music. I guess those videos are supposed to be up soon, but there was kind of a two-day working session on what's going to go into Istanbul and kind of the 1.x efforts in general. And Vitalik presented this remotely, and I guess it was pretty well received. The one thing is that I believe as Alexei was saying that we need some staffing and potential funding around testing this. So that was kind of the one pushback for now. I think there's kind of a plan being put around who can test it and a test plan, and then eventually kind of figure out what kind of funding is needed here. But in general, it seems to be, you know, people seem to like the idea. And I saw that in kind of the new staking validator rewards that were put out, it seemed like Justin and Vitalik were assuming, you know, 1559 was in, and that creates some burn, which kind of lowers the total network issuance, which is great to see. So progress being made there for sure.
Yeah. So as I said, big week, guys. We can jump into the news now. So the first thing I wanted to talk about was there's quite a big piece of news this week, and I put a tweet out about this as well. It was the auditing firm EY announcing their kind of what they're doing with Ethereum. So it's codenamed Nightfall. It's a platform that they've put out. They have 200 blockchain devs working on it, apparently. They're open sourcing the code. They're going to be using public Ethereum. And they're using zero-knowledge proofs for private transactions on public Ethereum. So this isn't just a private thing. It's not something that they're doing. I mean, they're obviously working on it in-house, but they're not just doing it for themselves where they'll, like, I think something like JP Morgan's doing it where they just create this private implementation built on Quorum, which is a fork of Go Ethereum, and kind of play around with it in their little sandbox environment. This is actually going to be hitting public Ethereum. And they're just so ambitious. Like they're open sourcing their code as well. Like this is code that EY's kind of paid these people to write, and they're just literally giving it away for free. So this was incredibly bullish for me. This is probably one of the most bullish announcements I've seen in a long time for Ethereum. You know, something like this would have definitely moved the price in 2017, but, you know, bear market things. But I guess it doesn't really matter. It just shows that more people, more companies, you know, these big companies are getting involved with public Ethereum. So, yeah, it was just really, really great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, this is huge, kind of piggybacking on the JPM news. And I suppose this means, you know, years of hard work with the EEA and kind of corporate adoption are starting to pay off. What's really interesting here is, A, they're using the public chain, which is awesome. They also said they have 200 blockchain devs working on this effort, which is a ton of resources, right? So at a minimum, hopefully, like as this stuff starts to go live and they start diving into zero knowledge proofs and the privacy side of thing, I mean, hopefully, obviously, these EY and JPM have tons of money and funding, right? And they have the ability to hire a lot of resources. Ideally, that kind of creates a lot of research and development that comes out of it that the public chain and those working outside of large corporations can start to use, right? So I see kind of like beyond just the adoption, hopefully that aspect is very large too. But yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot. I personally think this is where JP Morgan's going to. They've hinted at it that eventually the JPM coin is going to interact with public blockchains. And I'm sure they're going to be diving into privacy. That kind of seems to be a big thing. I believe it was like ING back was looking at it as well, and now EY. So it's kind of natural for these companies to start on a more private implementation and start to interact with the public chain. So, you know, obviously nothing but bullish to see kind of the largest financial institutions in the world start to adapt Ethereum.
Yeah, exactly. And in case everyone was wondering kind of what use cases EY sees for basically a public Ethereum blockchain, a lot of them go back to what people were talking about before the DeFi movement spun up. So a lot of what people were talking about in 2017. So it was use cases such as like supply chains, food tracing, transactions between branches of a company, and kind of public finance. They actually said public finance, which is, you know, whether they actually mean open finance or decentralized finance. I think they, you know, in given the context of everything else that they've announced, I think that they actually do mean that, which, you know, is even more bullish that the big companies thinking about, you know, open finance or DeFi, which is insane because at the end of the day, we love to kind of do this stuff in our own little sandboxed environment on Ethereum. But if we have these bigger companies on board and they actually see the benefits, both cost and kind of social benefits of having this open finance stack, then we can start to work towards that ultimate goal of kind of decentralizing, finance. At the end of the day, that's what one of the major goals of Ethereum, to basically make it a fair playing field for everyone. So yeah, I mean, I can't wait to see what EY comes out with in the future. I can't wait to see them start actually doing stuff on mainnet and you know, showing that these real use cases are out there to all the naysayers, basically. Cool. So the next thing I want to talk about was consensus. So consensus, everyone knows consensus. Everyone loves consensus. It's the kind of Ethereum incubator co-founded by Joe Lubin, founded by Joe Lubin, the original co-founder of Ethereum. But yeah, so the reason they're in the news this week is because they're seeking $200 million in new funding. So, you know, we've spoken about this on the podcast, and I'm sure everyone's aware consensus kind of he was hit very hard by the bear market in 2018. They had to lay off some staff due to it as, consensus was funded primarily, I think, out of Joe Lubin's pocket from the ether he bought at the crowd sale, which is fine if the price is going up, of course, but it becomes very difficult if, the price dumps as much as it did, which is over 90% for ETH. So yeah, they're seeking $200 million in funding. They're seeking a $1 billion valuation. But the thing that gives me pause is that they're seeking this large valuation, but they only made, I think it was $22 million in revenue in 2018, and they're only projecting a $50 million revenue for 2019. So I'm not sure, maybe they're valuing, I guess, the company based on the fact that they expect there to be another bull market and they expect this stuff to grow kind of exponentially. So in the next few years, their revenue will grow in the same way. I'm not sure. Like consensus obviously makes a lot of money from, maybe it's not obvious to people, but they do things like security audits and consulting, and they do different events like Ethereal and things like that. And of course, they had their token sale Spoke that they've kind of either spun out or kind of spun down, I think, because of the bear market. But yeah, I'm curious to see what other ways they can make money to kind of justify that $1 billion valuation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to me, what's going to be most interesting here is to see how much they get, because I've kind of been curious, like how much, you know, VCs or how much people wanting to raise money and down this type of traditional avenue can get for blockchain products. Because, you know, obviously consensus has some huge staples in the space, right? They have Infura, they have MetaMask, they have Truffle, like they have a lot of good products. They also have a lot of fat that they, you know, unfortunately had to trim and maybe will still have to get some funding. I'm not sure. I'm sure they make a lot off their consulting business, and, you know, they obviously do a lot for the space and have a lot to offer. The question is, yeah, like these projects aren't really monetizing yet. So kind of do the venture capitalist or whoever they're trying to raise from see the value, like how much to them is the value in this kind of name of consensus, right? As let's assume Ethereum goes through another bull market and gets more popular over time. Like, how much is just having that brand and kind of staple name, despite maybe some of their top products not actually making too much revenue at this point? You know, that's kind of how traditional investing works, right? It's like, hey, establish yourself in a name. You can lose money for now, but in the future, we'll find a way. So I'd be really, really interested to see how this plays out. And I think if they end up surprising people and getting a large raise, I think it could potentially be a unique funding avenue for a lot of the projects out there that are looking for it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important that we hit on the kind of reputation that Consensus has and how they're kind of like the incubator or think tank, like a private incubator think tank for Ethereum. You know, I think that they do a lot of good. They've put out a lot of great products already, you know, MetaMask, Infura, two of the major ones that they just give away for free. So they definitely have Ethereum's best interests at heart, and they really want to help move it forward. They've got protocol devs as well working on ETH1.x and ETH2. So yeah, I really do hope they can, you know, get this funding, get the funding they need to keep progressing forward until maybe the price goes up again and then they don't need the funding anymore. It seems to be a common trend amongst a lot of these blockchain projects or kind of blockchain companies, I guess you could say. So that's it for the news this week. So project updates now. The big one, the awesome one that this made me so happy. Validator rewards there's a proposal to increase them in ETH 2.0. So Eric, we have been pushing this for quite a while. We thought the rewards were too low, especially because of all the DeFi rates that are coming around. There's been a proposal to increase this. Quite a bit, actually. There's a table that you tweeted out, Eric, and I've linked it in the newsletter, but basically they're targeting kind of 30 million ETH staking or validating. That would mean an annual return rate of 3.3% for validators. Now, 30 million ETH is a lot, right? There's probably not even going to be that many people staking at any given time. So there's kind of like this table that outlines what it's going to be. It actually pays the people a lot more when it's lower. So this is what we were pushing for, because I posted on our community forum saying that when phase zero goes live, it's going to just be obviously the Beacon chain and no shard chains. It's not going to be any, you can't do smart contracts or anything on it, right? So, and it's a one-way bridge as it currently stands. So in order to incentivize those kind of mercenary stakers or those people who want to stake first, you need that high reward at the start. So I think they've taken this on board and they've put forward this thing where even if only 1 million ETH is validating, there's an 18% return rate for the year. And then once you jump up to 3 million, it becomes a 10% return rate. So it kind of gets exponentially less the higher you jump up as well. So that's what we were hitting on, that we thought it should be higher at the start. There are people who disagree with this, of course, and you know, they think that the rewards for the 1 million ETH validating is too high because maybe a whale could game it or something like that. But I'm not sure a whale would want to, you know, essentially lock up their ETH for maybe over a year on the Beacon chain, right? You know, things may change as well. This does depend on if the Beacon chain, if there's a two-way bridge between the Beacon chain and ETH1. That would actually change my thinking a lot. But as it currently stands, it was just basically great to see this. I know that, Eric, you've looked at a lot of the economics here. What are your thoughts around this?
Yeah, I mean, this is great. I love kind of the process this went through. Like, it was the initial rewards were proposed, and a lot of people did analysis and research around it. And the teams, the developers and researchers on ETH 2.0 were like, okay, everyone do your research. And then once we kind of get to a point later in the spec, we'll take a look at it. And in my opinion, they've hit the nail on the head. I'm in full agreement with what's out there. You know, it's Justin Drake said, like, ideally he would like to see around 30 million total staked, which if you kind of include burn rates that would be happening through EIP 1559, even at 30 million Ether staked, validators are probably looking around like a 5%, technically 3.5 to 5%. The 3.5 would be no burnage happening, but up to about 5% return for validators, which is still really attractive. At that point, you have like basically a million validating nodes on the network, which is, you know, extremely decentralized, which is great to see. And at the same time, the network issuance rate is as low as like 0.5%. So even though the validator is getting paid nicely, we're keeping that network issuance low. So everything about this looks great. Like you mentioned, you know, the 18% at 1 million, even at 3 million validators are still getting paid 10%. So I think this is going to attract a lot of people that are in ETH for the long haul during phase 0 and 1. So we're going to get kind of that necessary necessary security we need to eventually ideally finalize the ETH 1.0 chain with the 2.0 chain. So definitely recommend people go look. We've updated our ETH Hub ETH 2.0 economics page to reflect this and kind of put some comments from Vitalik and Justin, who put out this initial pull request on GitHub for this. So definitely go have a look. And you know, I'm personally excited about this, and I kind of mainly like the iterative process that this went through. And from what I see, at least in some of the forums I look to for consensus as far as on a social aspect, it seems like people are on board with this.
Yeah, exactly. I do think most people are. There are a couple of people who bring up valid points as to why the reward shouldn't be that high or something like that. And it's all on our forum. So if you want to join in, there's a thread on our community forum. I think it was called ETH2 Staking Rewards or something like that. You can jump in there and get involved with the conversation if you have an opinion on this, which would be really cool to see. But yeah, I also wanted to touch on one thing. You mentioned that Vitalik was talking about how different things on Ethereum would lead to less issuance. I think a big thing that he was talking about, obviously, was ERP-1559, the burning of the fees. But he also spoke on Reddit, and he goes, combining the individual and collective penalties of validators going offline, every 1% of validators offline cuts total issuance by around 3%. So he's probably expecting validators to get slashed just for going offline some of the time, which probably is a fair expectation considering that it's going to be, unless you're kind of staking with someone, it is quite hard to achieve like that kind of 100% uptime. You're never going to get 100%, but even the really high uptime, unless you're doing it through a kind of data center or something like that, even then, for some reason, your node could crash or something like that. And maybe if you're not monitoring it, then you'll lose some of your stake for being offline. It's not a big loss. Like if you go offline, the kind of leak is very low, and it can only leak you to, I think it's 28 ETH. So of the 32 ETH minimum, you'll lose 4 ETH and then it'll kick you out of the validator set. So you won't lose any more after that. And that will take actually quite a while from memory. But yeah, so he just basically goes through these other things that can put pressure on the issuance essentially. And like transaction fees being burned, of course, for 1559, but also being burned for state rent as well. And obviously we have other things like locked in DeFi, ETH getting lost, ETH locked as staking, or just all these different mechanisms that come into it that would reduce the overall issuance of Ether, even if it's high, you know, in general, because not many people are staking as well. So there are a few levers we can play with, and I'm sure this is going to change, but it's good to see that they're considering, or that they've come to realize that, you know, the community thinks it's best that the issuance be higher because of all the competing rates through DeFi and things like that. So yeah, I'm curious to see this evolve and see how it shakes out in the kind of the final version when it goes live.
Yeah, I mean, the sweet spot to me is we pretty much always want to assure network issuance, I would say like 1% max. And I think given how much we're going to see staked, I don't expect ever, you know, 100,000 Ether being staked. I expect something around, or 100 million, sorry. I expect around 30 million or so. So as long as we kind of keep that upper bound on issuance around 1%, which this would do, and at the same time, making sure you're securing the network enough through paying, incentivizing validators. And I think this is a great happy medium and trade-off.
Yeah, exactly. I think the community rallies around the 1% or less overall network issuance just in perpetuity, which I think is the sweet spot end of the day. I think that's enough for a very long time, considering that I believe that the Ethereum economy is going to be growing a lot more than 1% each year. And it kind of oscillates as well. Like if you have, I was doing some napkin math in my head the other day, and I didn't know if it made total sense, but I had this idea that, you know, if you have 1% that's issued each year of ETH, if that just goes into perpetual staking, or if that just goes back into DeFi or something, and then the kind of locked in DeFi staking offsets that that issuance, then obviously it's still the ETH still exists, and we still have inflated, I guess, the ETH supply. But if it just gets perpetually staked, then you can kind of sell it as, okay, well, it's locked in general, it's staked. Like we don't know that it's going to obviously be perpetually staked, but if it kind of becomes that, you can say that there was effectively zero issuance increase for the year. I know that the economists are probably going to say I'm wrong there, and that's why I haven't kind of made this a public opinion before. But yeah, there are a lot of moving parts here, and I'm curious to see how it actually plays out once the Beacon Chain goes live, once we have phase one and two, of course, and ETH2 is in full swing, to see how people behave with DeFi and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the other thing you have there too is just lost ether, right? I always say I think the amount of lost ether is a lot higher than people imagine. I think as time goes on, that number probably tails down, because early on people just kind of forgot about it or lost their private keys. But even at 0.5% network issuance a year, it's possible that probably not that much, but we're losing enough as a network as a whole through private keys or people dying and not having backup plans that it's essentially a net zero.
Yeah, exactly. And there's always going to be things like smart contract bugs, which lock ETH as well at the end of the day. Okay, cool. So yeah, if you want to check that out, go to the forum and check out the post and get involved there. I'll move on to the next update for the week. So ENS, the Ethereum name system, they're upgrading. Finally, the major upgrade. So if you own a .eth domain, you'll need to visit manager.ens.domains between May 4th 2019 and May 4th, 2020. So you've got a whole year. So this just migrates your domain to the new registrar. I think the biggest thing with this new system is going to be the new rent that they're putting in. So each domain will have a yearly rent of about five US dollars in Ether per year. The team put out a blog post about this, kind of explaining where this money is going to go. It's curious because the key holders of the ENS system, there's seven of them, and they're all deeply integrated within Ethereum. Two of them, off memory, is Nick Johnson, the lead developer on ENS, works for the EF, I think, works on Go Ethereum as well, and Taylor Monahan of MyCrypto. There's a few other big names in there, like I think Jared Hope from Status. Obviously, they have the best intentions of Ethereum at heart, so they'll do good with this money. They estimated that at the moment it's going to be, like, based on current registrations, it would be $250,000 per year in rent money. Obviously, we project that to go up, considering that ENS is going to become a staple. A lot of people are probably going to use it because it lets you assign words to Ethereum addresses, essentially, or phrases or things like that. They basically put out this post where they explain that the money's going to be used. Well, they plan to use the money to do this. I mean, they don't have to at the end of the day, but they do want to give back to the community. So they plan to use the money for something like giving grants to other projects, giving back to the Ethereum Foundation for helping them through funding and things like that, using it to pay gas costs for the creation of ENS domains. So kind of like an app pays for user sort of thing. Or burning it at the end of the day. I don't think that they should burn it because it's just a waste. I don't really care about lowering issuance through burning from ENS. Like, I just think that the money could be used a lot better, especially for grants to other projects. I think they should focus on that first. And they did say in the blog post that these are going to be their kind of first priorities. So I really hope that I actually do trust that they'll give grants to the projects that need it the most, especially through Gitcoin. It's just really cool to see that they're not just going to take this rent and just run with it. At the end of the day, I think a lot of them already make a decent living off what they're doing, whether that's Taylor with MyCrypto, Nick in his other work on Go Ethereum and things like that, or in ENS in general. If they were to pay themselves in some capacity, I wouldn't actually blame them, because obviously everyone needs to eat, at the end of the day. I do think they have the best interest of Ethereum at heart, and I think this rent will be used in the right way.
Yeah, this is extremely interesting to me. I mean, I've been a fan of the ENS since the start. I believe that a lot of people have, right? And I guess shameless plug, but one of the early episodes, we had Nick Johnson on from the ENS. So highly suggest, if you're a new listener and haven't listened to that, to go listen, because we talk about the new register and how this is all going to work. This got me thinking, I guess first I'll start with the ENS. They're probably going to produce a decent amount of funds with this. I'm sure they'll keep a little bit to staff their team and their developers, but if Ethereum continues to grow, obviously, like, normal domain names, there's millions of them, right? And the rent fees coming from that are astronomical. So there's a lot of potential here. I think that beyond, it seems to me, I totally agree with you. They'll probably give it back to some projects. I'm not sure how they're going to do it. I mean, I guess I don't, it's not my project. I don't really want to make suggestions for how they should do things, but if they do give it back, I say just leave it up to themselves. They've got a lot of good team members on there that have the best interests of Ethereum at heart, and it's their kind of project's money. And I think they should give it out and not kind of overcomplicate things by creating a DAO for this and just creating all kinds of drama, how these funds are going to be managed. Just create a grant system, elect a panel for it in a centralized way, and just do it, right? Like, these teams need funding now. We shouldn't be debating all these fancy funding mechanisms over and over for the time being. What's interesting here, though, is like how, not just the ENS, but are there other ideas and projects that are out there like this that either haven't been built yet, where kind of a rental fee could be given to grants or some type of funding mechanism? Or are there even projects out there now like, I don't know, I don't want to call it specific ones because I don't want to have them, I kind of mess up their mechanism they have now, but even something like Uniswap, which kind of has like a 0.3% liquidity fee, could like a part of that go to funding projects because that team's not actually taking any directly? I think there's something here. There's definitely projects outside of just the ENS where it would kind of be a widely adopted thing on the Ethereum network, and the fees could go to funding public goods or projects. And I don't think anybody really complain about that, because when it comes to just owning your one individual domain, right, it's like $60 a year. So it's not like it's and you're actually getting good use out of it. So people aren't going to complain like it's a tax or anything like that. So I'd be interested to hear people's thoughts around this and kind of where we could push this general idea beyond just the ENS.
Yeah, I do actually want to quickly clarify. It's $5 per year, not per month. I actually wrote it down wrong. That's not Eric's fault. That's my fault. so it's $5 actually per year for each 7+ character ENS domain. So yeah, not $5 per month. So it is a lot less funding than the numbers Eric quoted. But yeah, my bad. Sorry, Eric.
No, that's fine. I think the less than 7 characters, though, are going to be more. Is that right?
I don't know for sure because I don't remember, but yeah, if someone wants to check it out, you can go read the blog post. It's linked in the newsletter.
Like it said, I guess they estimated 250K a year for now. So I guess if we just kind of assume some general growth of Ethereum, like it still will get, I guess, over a mil a year at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Fully expect this to grow. And I do expect other projects that are collecting rent to maybe give some back as kind of a public good. Definitely something I think they should all do. And I hope to see more of, basically. All right, the last thing I wanted to talk about was this, just a quick thing. Dharma put out a post this week called Refi with DeFi. So basically, they walk through how you can refinance your CDP with Dharma. Because we all know that at the moment, the CDP stability fee just keeps going up. And maybe people don't want to pay that much for their DAI loan, right? So they can just close out their CDP and move it over to Dharma and basically borrow DAI for a lot less. I can't remember the exact rate at the moment, but it is less than the current 14.5% stability fee on Maker. Now, this is cool because obviously it gives people more options, but at the end of the day, Dharma is still subsidizing a lot of this stuff themselves. So this gravy train won't last forever. It's not centralized, but it is centralized in the way that the subsidization, oh man, I've just stuffed that word up, is coming from Dharma themselves instead of it just being fully managed within the Maker system. So I think it is a good option for people who really don't want to pay that 14.5% stability fee but want to still have their loan. I'm not sure how many people will use it because, I mean, we could just merge these sections. We're going to discuss how the stability fee was raised to 14.5%, but basically, so I'm not sure how many people are going to do this refi, because at the end of the day, a 14.5% stability fee is still nothing compared to the amount of gains that these people can get. So if you think about it, if these people taking out CDPs are just basically going long ETH, which is basically everyone, then they're considering the fact that ETH is going to go up 100% or something, you know, within a year, which is not far-fetched at all. It went up 100% since the start of this year in 3 months. So that would absolutely eliminate any kind of fees from that 14.5%. That's nothing. That's negligible to how much money that they've made. There's a chart that I've tweeted out that Matteo from the block created where he goes through how profitable it is at each stability fee. And you know, even at 100% stability fee, if the ETH price only moves, I think it was 10% in a week, you're still like 3% in profit. So yeah, I'm not sure how many people are going to be doing these refi with DeFi, but I think it's a good meme to get behind, and it just shows like that you can do these kind of, you can quickly do these things instead of, you know, with traditional finance to refinance something, you'd have to go through obviously a bank and then it's just this, you know, this really clunky process. Whereas with this, you can do it in a few easy steps.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess just for one thing, how you, if people are curious, you were saying how Dharma seems to be subsidizing this. That's because right now you can lend out DAI on Dharma at, well, this is according to Loan Scan I'm looking at right now, which we talked about a few weeks ago. You can lend DAI on Dharma at 11%, but you can borrow DAI at 8.5%. So obviously that's flipped, right? There's a negative spread there. So they obviously are covering some of that spread themselves. So that wouldn't make much sense. So that's what Anthony's talking about there. And I don't know how long that's going to last. I think Dharma today put out a blog post kind of like how we work or some of the inner workings of their system. So I guess everybody should go read that. It's on my list this evening to go check out, because I've kind of seen a lot of questions about, you know, how long is my term? Can I exit early? Can I kind of top off my debt? Can I pay it down? Like there were a lot of questions that I think they kind of cleared up and answered there. I will say like their meme game is like 100 on this, right? Like refi with DeFi, whoever came up with that should be getting a raise or a bonus or something, because that's pretty solid. But I guess in general, like, there's so many options popping up on DeFi on the lending and borrowing space. It's good and healthy to see competition, I suppose. I'm more anxious to kind of see, though, once we truly let the free market take it, like we just mentioned, Dharma's kind of subsidizing this stuff right now. What's going to happen whenever we just kind of open the gates? Because there's weird arbitrage opportunities out there right now. The market's not too efficient, and over time, that's going to start to settle. So all these teams are great. They're building great products, and kind of, in my opinion, the baseline for the open finance future kind of moved on from decentralized finance. And I'm very glad we moved on from DOTFi, by the way. I haven't seen it for a while, so I'm glad we killed that thing with fire. But the word decentralized just isn't working for me these days. So I want to stick to open finance. I think these teams are kind of setting the baseline for open finance. So it's very interesting to kind of see them compete with each other.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny that you mentioned the word decentralized. I don't think I ever used that word before, you know, getting into crypto. It's not a commonly used word in, I guess, the English language for everyday people. Even the word centralized, I can't think of anything, any time in my life where I use those words outside of crypto to describe a lot of things. I mean, it depends what field you work in, of course, or whatever, but just in everyday conversation, they're not words that get used very often. Saying decentralized finance is probably confusing. I always think that we should just leave that as a kind of an internal thing, whereas like the public facing thing should be open finance. But then, you know, open finance, I mean, does it really mean anything on the surface to everyday people? Who knows? Like, it's just, I think these kind of terms will become what the information superhighway was to the internet back in the day. And then we'll just have more education around this, and then people will settle on a term and everyone will just start using that instead of, you know, arguing over what we should use.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So the last thing, or second last thing actually, I wanted to talk about was the stability fee, the maker stability fee being raised again. And I just saw this morning that they're actually going to raise it again. This is getting a little out of hand. A lot of people are getting really annoyed about this, especially, obviously CDP holders. I've been thinking, and I've seen a bit of chatter about this, where the maker system is kind of at odds with, like, the users are at odds with each other. So you've got a lot of the users who are literally just leverage longing ETH, which is fine. That's obviously a great use case and the main use case for Maker at the moment. But then you also have users that are kind of taking loans on their crypto from themselves in order to buy things at the end of the day. So if they want to buy, you know, furniture for their house, or if they, like, there's that famous blog post where someone remortgaged their house or kind of refinanced with Maker their home loan, basically, to get a cheaper rate, which I think has been completely wiped out now that the stability fee is so high. So they're at odds with the fact that a lot of people are just going leverage long on ETH and they don't give a shit if the stability fee even goes to 100%, right? So, I don't know. I think the stability fee is a very poor lever, especially with ETH being the only form of collateral, because, you know, as I just explained, ETH going up is not 100% and a short amount of time is not unheard of, or even more than that, which means this stability fee doesn't mean shit to these big CDPs. A lot of the ETH locked, it belongs to a handful of CDPs, which I've been monitoring them. They don't really wipe their debt. They just take out more DAI and buy more ETH. They don't care at all. So yeah, I'm really interested to see if this kind of constant raising continues until we're at whatever we're going to be at, because it seems very ridiculous to keep raising it and burn customers. There's a lot of people that are saying this is going to just turn people off Maker. I can see how that might work, but then these people are just going to come back once stability fee gets lowered again. Like, people, they're not going to let their emotions run rampant. Well, most people, at least some people do, but they're not going to let their emotions cloud their kind of, need to get cheap debt. Like, if they want cheap debt, if the stability fee goes back to 0.5%, they're not going to say, oh, the stability fee was 14.5% back, a few months ago, I don't want to use the Maker system anymore. No, they're not going to do that. Like, if you're smart and not letting your emotions cloud your judgment here, you're going to take that 0.5% loan and go long on ETH. Like, it's as simple as that. You're literally, by not doing that, if you're a trader, if you're an investor, by not doing that, you're leaving money on the table. Yes, there's a risk to it, but at the end of the day, it's not a huge risk compared to other avenues. So I don't expect these stability fee hikes to really burn a lot of users. It might burn the users that took it out for purchasing things, not just for leverage longing ETH. But yeah, it's just a weird space to be at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I'm extremely torn on this one. I agree that I think people will come back. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is kind of single collateral DAI isn't a fully finished solution, right? So once we go to multi-collateral DAI, there's going to be the DAI savings rate, which is going to help kind of pass the stability fee onto kind of a savings account for people that want it. And then that's supposed to kind of balance the supply and demand. So we shouldn't see this volatility in the stability fee. I do think Maker's starting to hurt themselves though. And it's almost becoming a meme to me. Like, we're bringing it up every week and neither of us are really that involved in it, right? Like, I don't hold Maker. I'm not involved in the CDP process or voting on the fees or anything like that. But they're kind of memeing in that, oh, another week, another stability fee. And like, people are laughing at how high that is because it's basically up to like a credit card rate, right? And I know this is kind of the lever that the Maker team wants to use, and this is just their system, and that's the reality of the situation, right? But at the end of the day, they do have another lever, which is the supply cap. It's 100 million now. I think there's like 90 million DAI drawn. So theoretically, they could lower that to kind of offset. And I know they've said they don't want to use that as a lever. But I do think they're doing themselves a little bit of a disservice as far as not brand recognition, but just it's kind of becoming a joke, right? And what people don't really want, and so I guess I'll counter you a little bit in saying I don't think people want this the fear of wild volatility in their borrowing rate, right? So you said that people are refinancing their home, or like I saw someone like was buying a car with a CDP because of the low rate. Well, like those people are screwed now, right? And like people blame the traditional financial system for kind of having hidden fees and rate hikes. And obviously there's adjustable rate mortgages, but they do have like a 5-year lock and then they reset every 1 year after that. So you kind of know it's schedule. I think that the biggest disservice Maker's doing here is kind of giving people a fear of how volatile their debt rate can be. And I don't think that's something that people really want. Now, the reality is, like you said, people are really just probably using these to long ETH. So that's kind of a whole different market. But I think that the Maker team should be careful on kind of how they juggle these two things, right? Like, the optics of the situation are very important too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can see that point. At the end of the day, volatility is very dangerous. Maker was created to take out the volatility, of cryptocurrencies by issuing DAI. I don't know. I think this is just growing pains. I mean, you mentioned that they were memeing the fact that the stability fee is going up. I don't think they can do much else at the end of the day. It obviously is a serious thing, but they are a startup or a company at the end of the day. They want people using their product. So they definitely want to make it out as if it's not as bad as it is, which is fine. I guess it's only really bad, as I said, for people who have taken, refinanced their home loan or taken money out to buy things other than just going along on ETH. Whereas, the people who are going along on ETH don't seem to care at all about the raising stability fee, basically. So, yeah, I mean, there's also the other kind of aspect to it where people are saying that maker holders currently don't bear any risk at all and they just get all the upside from this because obviously the CDP fees are paid in MKR that's burnt, which means that it theoretically should increase the MKR price. I don't know if, you know, the people voting on these sorts of things are actually just doing it for their own benefit because MKR went up without the stability fee skyrocketing as it did like a couple of months ago. It went up because people were just talking about the Maker system and everyone was praising it and it was getting so much attention. But now the price, or I guess the ratio against ETH for MKR has actually gone down a lot, even though the stability fee is really high and obviously the fees being generated are going to be more in the future when people pay down their CDPs. So yeah, I mean, I know a few prominent people in the community have tweeted about this and about how, you know, Maker holders, the system's kind of out of balance right now in terms of incentives of with CDP holders and DAI holders and MKR holders. A lot of this is going to change, obviously, when multilateral DAI comes along and we got the DAI savings rate as well. The kind of mechanism changes in that, you know, there's a bit of the stability fee that's paid through the DSR. There's a bit that's going to be paid to the Maker holders. So it should create a more holistic system where all the different parties are incentivized to do, you know, what's best for them. But it also kind of reaches a kind of, I guess, to use the buzzword, Nash equilibrium in kind of the game theory of the system. So, I mean, you know, I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent here, but this system just really, even though this, I'm quite annoyed that the stability fee has gone up this high, I can feel people's pain. It's just really interesting to see this play out because I don't think I've seen something like this ever in kind of a decentralized system or on Ethereum at least. So yeah, just really cool to watch, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Maker is one of the most important projects and it's obviously going to survive this and be fine. And the impact's pretty low at this point, given how few DAI is drawn in the scheme of things. But yeah, I think it's an example of let's make sure we don't always have rose colored glasses on, right? Like there's always going to be a flip side to some of this stuff. And it's kind of amazing in a way that no one kind of realized that the fee could go this high. Like it was a very basic mechanism of the system. And now people are like kind of taken aback and shocked by it. So it's always good to see both sides of these things, in my opinion. And not everything is perfect.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, enough on the stability fee. Last thing, the podcast is going a bit long this week, but I really, really wanted to hit on this week. So you mentioned at the start of the podcast, there was a couple of days where a lot of the core devs met in Berlin and they talked about ETH 1.x and Istanbul coming up as well, which I guess is part of ETH 1.x these days. I've seen a lot of conversation around ETH 1.x not getting enough attention. It's not getting enough attention from kind of the community in general, developers, funding as well, of course. I think we as a community can do better. So I wanted to kind of give a call to arms to everyone listening on this, and I'm going to actually be putting out relevant tweets and kind of maybe create another tweet thread about ETH 1.x. I want people to kind of understand that ETH 1.x is just as important as ETH 2.0 to the future of Ethereum. Now, if you don't know what ETH 1.x is, I won't go into detail about it here. You can go to ETH Hub and you can check out our page on it and it'll explain everything to you. But at a higher level, it's basically a series of upgrades to the Ethereum 1.0 chain that will keep it sustainable for the years to come. Now, it's not just that as well. This is where it ties into ETH 2.0, is that a couple of the things such as state rent and EWASM are going into ETH 2.0. So ETH 1.x is a kind of testing ground for these sorts of things and lets us work in parallel because at the moment, the ETH 2.0 work is mainly focused on phase 0 and phase 1. EWASM won't go until phase 2 and state rent maybe even later than that. So we have an awesome opportunity right now to see these things play out on a live network, which has tons of activity on it and see what works best before porting this over to ETH 2.0, because ETH 2.0 is a fresh slate for Ethereum. It's kind of a clean slate where we get to start again and we get to basically make the system that was originally envisioned and port over the current network effects to that new blockchain, essentially. I'm going to be putting out tweets and stuff like that. I do implore the community to look more into ETH 1.x and start talking about it a lot more. Especially on our forum, our community forum. There's a couple of threads on there already. I know DC Investor ported a tweet thread that he was involved in over to it as well, which is really cool. So yeah, definitely go check that out and keep an eye on both. I mean, I know Eric, you're gonna put some stuff out as well. So definitely keep an eye on our Twitters. And then there are a few people that you should follow in the ETH1.X kind of area. Obviously, Alexi, which is the lead. We had him on the podcast a few weeks ago. There's Boris Mann, which is getting more involved now. I can't remember all the people off the top of my head. I'll probably, you know what's good? I actually probably put it like together a tweet thread and then put it on ETH Hub of who you should follow to keep up with ETH1.X and what you can do to help, basically.
Yeah, for sure. We also have that page that we just paid out a bounty for, which gives a lot of detail around 1.X. So if you're not too familiar with it, go check that out. I definitely agree with you. And I do think the community is like willing to help as far as helping fund this, but there's also not much detail around like what the 1.X team needs and the resourcing it has and kind of what they need for testing and research and, you know, a staff size they want to get to and how much funding that's going to require. So I'd also challenge them, anybody listening to this from the 1.X team. I feel like if we got that out there, we could really kind of help champion a raise and pushing this effort forward. But as far as just kind of saying like, you know, oh yeah, we need funding, which obviously they do. And I fully agree with, I think people will more rally behind some, like real details. So I think you putting out some content around that will help too.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, keep an eye on, you know, our Twitters for that. Keep an eye on ETH Hub, relevant channels, the forum and everything. And yeah, we'll get it done. Basically, we'll put the spotlight on ETH1.X. Awesome. That's it for this week, everyone. Thank you for listening again. If you haven't subscribed to the newsletter, go to ethhub.substack.com. You can subscribe to the podcast you're listening to by going to podcast.ethhub.io. Definitely go check out the forum, community.ethhub.io. Go get involved. We'd love to hear from everyone that's listening on the podcast. Of course, if you think you have something to say, it's open to everyone. And yeah, we don't really police it in a way that that shuts anyone down. And don't feel intimidated either. We're all learning at the end of the day. There's a lot of different community members in there. You can go into the intro yourself thread on the community forum and see the kind of diverse set of people that we have in there from different types of backgrounds, and, you know, introduce yourself as well. So yeah, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethhub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.